Conference record has joined the conference.
I don't know what happened to several of our colleagues, but we are going to resume. Where did Jim go? Where did Mark go?
Like herding cats.
I know. Linda, do you know where Mark is? Have you seen him?
Oh. Yes. Then comes the revolution. I know an old nursing home that threw out its board of directors that way.
Thank you. All right. So I just want to recap. So everyone, please try to stay with us. So thus far, we have basically agreed that we would do recommendations having to do with the education process that's needed, given the unique nature of our population, as well as a quality scorecard. I'm using that term as a shortcut for informing consumers. We've also agreed on our general idea of a comprehensive set of Medicaid long-term care services that would be paid through a risk-based payment system. So those are the things we've agreed upon. We need to move ahead to take a look at our other care coordination model principles, reach some kind of consensus on what they need to be so that we can bring them forward to the entire MRT. We also wanted to reach agreement on some key guidelines for the transition, and I just put in one, which was trying to ensure continuity to the fullest extent possible. So the other thing we've agreed upon is that Mr. McNally will go back and take these principles and put them through the prism of a consumer perspective and rewrite them so they are not in any way not consumer-centric. Okay, so there are a whole set of principles having to do with care management, person-centered care management, in fully involving the individual in formal supports and the development and execution of the care plan. I'm assuming that people are comfortable with those principles, but if you're not, I'd like to hear about it. Then, Michael.
I'm not uncomfortable with the principles, but, and I understand that three is drafted in a way that, you know, it uses phrases, be involved, must participate, and that's short of being fully responsible for.
Right.
And I understand that there's also a vision of a of an integrated Medicare acute care, Medicaid long-term care benefit for duals down the road. But in the near term, when we have a care coordination model, but we might not have, or at least don't fully control whether we have full Medicare and Medicaid integration for duals, I just want to sort of, on the ground, walk through what it means when we say, as an interim approach, the CCM must participate in coordinating care with, and I insert the word Medicare before primary and acute care services. So if I'm an MLTC plan partial cap, and I'm serving a dual that's in a Medicare Advantage plan, what is the state, in its regulatory role, what is the state telling me I must do when I approach a Medicare Advantage plan that I have no contractual relationship with?
Okay, I don't know.
Mark, Linda, caller, if you...
Linda.
Yeah, it's more from a provider perspective, so that the managed long-term care plan is responsible for working with the PCP, you know, following the person to the doctor's office, knowing what happened at the cardiologist's office.
Okay, but Medicaid doesn't. Okay, but
they're not paying for them. They're just care managing. They're knowing that the person now has, you know, discontinued the cardiology med and has changed to a different one.
And so how does the MLTC plan find that out? Because the cardiologist is not in the MLTC plan network. The cardiologist is being paid by Medicaid.
That's right.
So how does the plan find that out?
They may call the doctor's office and get that information from the doctor's office. They can get the information from the member, from the family. They could send somebody along with that member.
I revise my comment that I'm not uncomfortable with the principle. I feel like that's a principle that is just, you know, too difficult to ask care coordination models to adhere to.
You're raising the question of how feasible, how do you make this happen?
Okay, Joe?
We do this right now. I mean, the nurse works with, even though it may be a partial cap product only that our member is in, the nurse works with that patient member, their physician, gets orders, sort of coordinates services. That all happens right now. If they're going to specialists, that all happens right now for the MLTCs. Even though there isn't a contractual relationship, we don't pay that physician or we don't pay the hospital if they get admitted, that nurse and the aide, et cetera, they're all working together already.
I understand that happens on the ground. I think that that's great work. It's often heroic work under difficult circumstances. It doesn't matter principle. You know, if this is a principle that is going to spawn regulation for these care coordination models that tells them they have to do things that they don't fully control. I think there is.
Yeah,
let's
I mean,
just take a breath
right.
and say, are we going to put on equal footing with our other principles, which I think are wonderful in Maine? Are we going to put on equal footing a principle that says a new care coordination model on top of everything else they're going to have to accomplish is going to be on the hook for things that they can't control?
Yeah, no, and I don't think that's what we're saying. I think what we're saying
but
is
that's
just
what
look
this
at
is.
No, but look at just the title, not the description. A CCM must be involved in care management of other services which is not at risk. So be a care management. A CCM must be involved with. It's not must.
Well, it says must participate in coordinating care with primary
must,
and
but I'm talking about is the title. The
right.
principles are the titles, not the explanation.
Right. Principles
fun. Right.
The title fun.
Right. So the problem is an interim approach. So let's go to the paragraph below. So your problem is must engage in coordinating care.
Why? My verse says must participate in.
Okay.
I have much engagement, but
yeah.
Michael, can you modify this
yeah.
in a way that makes you comfortable? Not the principle,
right,
but underneath it. You don't have to do it now.
Yeah, sure.
Can you go back and work on it?
Yeah, I guess what I do then is in order to sort of make sure that there is an issue. What would let's flip it? What would happen if a care coordination model tried but was unsuccessful in coordinating care with coordinating.
So then try to capture the trying and the attempt.
Very good.
Okay.
I'm actually suggesting that maybe the language that was shared with by the association does try to do that. It says reasonably possible and practical in coordinating care. So do we need to reinvent language again?
No, that sounds very reasonable.
That sounds good.
Sounds good.
Just say it doesn't work, Michael.
Thanks, John. I do
appear. All right, that's good. Kathy, did you have something you wanted to weigh in on?
Well, I was just going to say that this issue just points out why the rest of that principle is really important, because when you have these sort of conflicting care coordinating entities, it's very, very difficult to really manage the whole person. And so the second part, moving to a more integrated approach, is really critical, I think.
Right. I mean, I do think it's not easy, but I know in our managed long-term care, the nurse coordinator actually goes to some of the physician visits with the enrollee when they're pivotal. So it's not easy, but I think it makes a big difference in trying to mesh all these gears together. Okay, if we're okay on the care, the person-centered care management and involving individual and informal support, let's go to number 5, which basically says for the benefit package services, CCM members will have a choice of providers. Are there any issues with that principle? Anyone who doesn't love it? Yes?
I have to think about it.
Okay.
I still go back to this issue of...
All right, think about it. We'll come back. I won't forget you. All right. Anyone else? Joanne.
Should we clearly articulate that a consumer has a choice of a CCM and within that a choice of providers? Because I don't see the clarity that says you have to have a choice of CCM, and I think that's core to what we have been talking about, is there has to be that capacity before there is.
Okay. Right. I think we'll try to get that included.
And how do we define informal support?
Let's see. Informal supports, I think.
How do you define it?
Go ahead.
Well, that's my point, though. How, if we don't have a definition of what it is, how are we actually going to know whether they have actually done it? Well,
I think you have to rely on the enrollee to define informal supports. In this day and age, when traditional families are changing, people have networks of friends, and they may have religious leaders involved. I don't think we can define for others what their informal support network is comprised of.
So I guess it goes back to my writing from the perspective, then I as a consumer, I get to tell the CCM my
phone. That's right.
They have to.
Right. So you, when you rewrite it,
yeah.
Keep that in mind. I want my informal support to include Derek Jeter, but... I noticed he and Minka Kelly have split, right? Okay. All right. Any other issues on the provider network and the choice? All right, then number 6. The issue of using a standardized assessment tool to drive care plan development, ultimately the UAS would be that standardized assessment tool.
I have a question about the not principle 6, but it's related to the assessment. Probably I should have raised it when we were on principle 1. But I think I continue to miss something. So let's say I'm a care coordination model, and let's say I'm a bad actor that Mark is trying to get out of the program. I'm assessing my enrollees, right? So I'm conducting an assessment knowing that the content of that assessment over which I have control will influence up or down my sort of risk-adjusted capitation payment. Is that an accurate description of what the combination of these principles result in? Is that okay?
So you're asking, is there an inherent conflict?
That is what I'm asking.
That's what you're getting at.
That is what I'm asking.
You're not looking at inter-rate or reliability here.
Right. That's what I'm asking.
Right. Paul, can tackle that?
Linda. In terms of what we do now, I mean, we have had iPro go out and do audits of the managed long-term care plan SAM assessments to make sure that what they are recording and submitting to us is consistent with what they're seeing in the care management record.
Right.
And we certainly plan to continue that.
I understand what we do now. And I asked the question in the spirit of the guidance we were given to look forward, not backward. So I guess I just restate, is that okay?
Well, let me say what's going forward with the uniform assessment tool. The difference between, there's differences between SAM and our UASNY. But the tool we're going to is going to be web-based, direct access, so that we're going to have a database that is much more robust than what the current plans provide and how they report. They report, some total every 6 months. The system that we're going to will be live, so the data will be live. We will be able to, if we wanted to and can, will be able to do, is use the system to recognize those types of issues. In addition, the tool that we are going to has already demonstrated inter-rater reliability. There's going to be ongoing training. I think all the questions you ask are related to how the instrument is used and how people are trained to use, much like MDS, OASIS, and other tools that have been used in the long-term care field for a number of years, that those tools do have an impact on other issues. So we plan to do those things.
Okay, so I guess, Michael, take a crack at crafting this in a way that gets a check in the system. You're asking for it.
No, I don't have a solution. And I have a question, and that was a really good answer, but it was a tactical answer from the department, and I was looking for a strategic answer from the work group. Is that okay? Can we live with, as a matter of strategy, is that an acceptable conflict that we can manage, or is it something that we need to continue to talk about? That's the question, and it's a question for the group.
I would tend to think that there's been a certain experience level up to now which is being further refined. So the question is, do you want to break it and refix it, or do you see something that's broken that needs fixing? If it's working and it's going to be tightened up and improved, what pieces of it do you see that you're not comfortable with that needs to be addressed as part of it?
Okay, Jim.
Who conducts the assessment?
It'll be the same individuals who conduct assessments now. I mean, if we're talking about...
Those individuals would be who?
For managed long-term care plans, it's the current assessors. They assess their own enrollees.
It is generally a clinician, usually a nurse.
Right.
Okay. So we'll require a nurse. So just, I understand Michael's point. I think it's a good point. I mean, the other side of that is an independent party does it, and there's a lot of problems with that. So how do you, what's the middle ground between an independent party and the self-interested party? I think it's a really good question. I think the fact that it's a clinician that's responsible, so you have that professional obligation, is part of the answer. The transparency of the process is part of the answer, but there may be other parts too.
Okay, Kathy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an issue, but it's really no different than almost any reimbursement methodology that incorporates an intensity factor. You have upcoding in DRGs, you have upcoding in different things, and there are just mechanisms to try try and look at that again and make sure people are doing it appropriately. It's really the same kind of idea.
I tend to agree with Kathy. For many other kinds of reimbursement systems, you generally have clinicians completing them, and there's always, you know, creep and other things you have to keep an eye on. I mean, Joe.
I agree, but I think when we roll out the new tool, I think the training is really important. And then perhaps, and we all probably want to do our own audits close in time to when that happens to make sure it's done and it works, et cetera. So I think it's a good point, Michael. I think it is about tightening up what we're doing now, including the post-enrollment audits. And I think for new organizations coming into this space who aren't used to this, then until they've got a track record of experience, more closer monitoring, I think, is the way to go. But I think we need to be careful not to go overboard with a process that fundamentally works, I think.
Okay, David?
Well, I guess this would go back to the a little bit of the discussion we had earlier today about social versus medical model thing. And my concern is if a nurse is doing the assessment, are we then greasing the skids for more medical services or at the expense of any social that may be determined? Is a nurse really the person best qualified to do that? I don't know the answer to that question. But I know CMS is very interested in conflict-free assessment, and does having a nurse to it that belongs to the entities that actually is being paid and providing the care pass that test?
No, I always think of it in a way, you know, you go to a physician's office, the physician does the assessment, and then the physician does the procedure. And, you know, we accept that, and there has to be some trust in professional judgment and integrity. I think you know, and I feel the same way about nurses and other clinicians and social workers. You have to have some trust in the integrity of their assessment. That doesn't mean there shouldn't be periodic checks, but I do think you have to have some baseline confidence in their performance.
Carol?
Yes.
I think one of the most important and the most valuable component of an MLTC is being able to respond to change. And the only way we could do that is by having our own staff in there every day to go in and do the assessment. And when someone is, the nurse does an assessment, but it's usually in partnership with a social worker.
Yeah,
so that if you're doing your care management, you're looking at not only the medical needs, the whole personal care needs, but what are the social needs and what other services may be necessary to put in. So I think it goes back to how a plan assesses the person's really needs based on their whole situation, their whole living, their whole life.
I mean, the only thing, you know, I was thinking of besides the issue of making sure we're monitoring and there is some check is just making sure that our assessment does look at social factors and mm-hmm. is not just focused on the medical factors. Okay. Carla.
I just wanted to add one more thing, a couple things. One, the tool that we are looking at is very expansive and does include many of the social and cognitive factors. And in the system, the way we're setting it up is that there will be the ability for more than one person to look at this and sign off on it. So there's also an inherent way to kind of do this, address the transparency issue that Jim talked about, as well as to engage other types of professionals than just the nurse going into the home and doing the assessment. So systems can help address some of these issues.
Will that include the members' input?
Yeah, we talked about that before when David
Sorry.
Raised the question of who are informal support. Okay, number seven, providing services in the most integrated setting. Melanie, let me just ask you if you're comfortable, because that reflects points that you have made before.
Yes, and I do
thank Mark. Speak into the microphone.
Sorry. Thank Mark for taking into consideration some of the comments we made. But again, I would still raise the issue of what is the state's role? It's the state's obligation, not the CCM's obligation, to comply with the Olmstead decision. So how is the state going to implement that? What is going to be the enforcement? Who's doing what to whom kind of thing? I don't really understand how that works out, how you can hand over through any process the state's legal requirement to ensure people are served in the most integrated setting.
Okay. I don't know. We need to think about that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other comments on that? All right. If not, yes, Joe.
I don't have specific content, but I'm just anticipating one of the issues that will come up because we will continue to enroll people who have been living in the community. And in some cases, questions come up about, is this really safe? And so, I mean, partly what's behind this is, what is safe, what isn't safe, where are the boundaries? I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not expert in that area. But it seems to me it is fundamentally a policy issue that we're going to have to address rather than let it play out in the case-by-case-by-case basis.
This is something that came up in late discussion at the subject work group meeting on the fair hearing, and one of the things that the plans had committed was something about when they could determine that they wanted guidelines from the state as to when they could determine someone was unsafe, which smacks right in the eye of Homestead.
Okay, Melon. Okay.
And I really think that it's individual. You cannot ask for a standard of safety because someone would look at me and say, I'm not safe in the community. So you really need to do this individually.
Okay, Melanie.
Well, and I think at the fair hearing subgroup, we talked about what legal standards are in place, both from regulation and case law, in terms of what is safety. We talked about using safety as a way to really limit hours rather than limit services. So that it was really a proxy for we don't want to provide the appropriate level of hours. And really, the bottom line issue for us is people have to make choices for themselves as well. There is dignity in taking risk in your personal life. Marilyn chooses to decide that she's safe, and clearly she is. So really, it's the individual's perspective that is primary in that determination, I would think.
Okay. All right. Number 8, which is the CCM will be evaluated to determine the extent to which it has achieved anticipated goals and outcomes, et cetera. That really sort of folds into what we're trying to work on in this quality subcommittee. But are there any comments on that particular principle? Yes, Joanne.
I don't know where to draw the line, but I would just hope that embedded in this principle is the concept that it's reasonable information, because I think all of us in healthcare now are feeling like we're inundated with requests for information that have minimal value to anyone. So I would just hope as we develop this, I don't think it has to necessarily, the principle doesn't have to change, I would just hope people would keep in mind making this reasonable and not unduly burdening the administrative costs associated with collecting and sharing and providing and analyzing data, because it's sometimes not value-added.
Well, I didn't mention this, but in our quality subcommittee, we had as one of our criteria parsimony, which means to be very careful and not triplicate the information and put burdens on providers. And the importance of being sure that what you're collecting really has some value. All right, number 9, sure, Kevin.
I was going to suggest that we put in the list of data we're collecting, workforce information on, as we discussed in other subcommittees.
Right, we did, when I gave the review of our subcommittee, I said we had agreed that there should be a quality metric on workforce, so we will incorporate that. Okay. And that was on continuity and stability and trying to measure that in some way. Okay, I'm on number 9, effective consumer protections for members. Melanie.
The issue I had with this one was that it's so vague. And so it, maybe even just a process within the principle itself or in the paragraph for how are we going to go about determining what this means? Because as it's stated, I mean, we haven't defined effective. We haven't defined, you know, other than what we already have under Medicaid managed care, and Valencia described that in detail, I think we've had more discussion here, at least when we were last down in this room, about the different kinds of protections that would be entailed. And I, definitionally, I'm a little, it's a little sketchy right now from my perspective.
Are you comfortable with putting pen, you know, to paper here and trying to put more specificity to this without putting us in a straitjacket?
I wouldn't have that.
All right, good.
I volunteer.
All right, Melanie, you're on. Okay. Number 10, a CCM will be able to serve specified populations.
You know, going along with what you said for number 10, I think what we talked about, if I remember, is that plans generically should have some kind of knowledge and expertise of a broad spectrum of populations, but that plans, if they choose or design or evolve into working with specific populations, that they should have to show minimum competency based on what the population is. And I think that needs to be defined, because I think if you, you know, as someone who does fair hearings a lot, you know, what one plan has a standard of and say, well, this is our standard for, we buy everyone this type of wheelchair or something like that. So that it has to somehow go hand in glove in, you know, what your population is, what their special needs are, and what expertise you have in this population. And what have you done to meet the specific needs of that population?
Yeah, I agree. I feel a lot more comfortable if there was another clause on here that said and should have a model of care appropriate to that population or something.
Yes.
Something like that.
Okay. Now, my view on number 11 is that it actually belongs in the transition category. So we now would have this in the transition category, and something, Jim, you said earlier about trying to ensure continuity to the fullest extent possible. So those would be kind of two transition principles. So I would have a transition category. Right. And so as you think about transition, how we get from here to there on an accelerated basis, what are the other things that we need to be sure we capture in thinking about transitions? Besides continuity issues, that mandatory should not begin unless there are adequate capacity and choice for consumers in a county.
Hi, jumping ahead, but that last thing you said, which is captured in number
I don't know, I have that as a number 11.
The new 6 is that a CCM should not be prevented from operating when market forces preclude them from offering choice. And then when we get over the back here, we have will not begin until there's adequate capacity. So we kind of seem to say the exact opposite. Or am I reading it?
All right, so
what they're proposing is what's in our goal, isn't it? Are you sure? Well, I think I'm either on old 5 or new 6, if you're reading off the EPA. CCM should not be prevented from operating in market forces.
Yes, the 5.
Is that their proposed language?
No, if you go to the website principle number 5, it says,
CCM should not be, however, there are geographic differences in the availability of service providers, and CCM should not be prevented from operating when market forces, lack of availability, or willingness to contract preclude a CCM from offering choice, or in perhaps some instances a particular service. That was the upstate rural issue.
Right. So in that one, we're saying there are going to be some instances where there's no choice, but you should still be allowed to operate. And then
right
over here, it says,
so I guess if, you know, we could add a where appropriate or where practicable or where possible, or I mean
maybe adequate capacity in the county may mean, I don't know what that means.
Okay. So we have to figure out how to reconcile.
Yeah, we need to reconcile those.
Okay. All right, let me just go back.
Can I just
make
one comment? Just in thinking about that comment, I think it had to do with scope of services, not just the number of providers, if I recall, because you have some upstate counties where if you mandate all the services that a coordinated care entity needs to provide, there are just some places around the state that it doesn't exist. And so, you know, it may very well be it'll be inconsistent with what happens in other parts of the state. But I don't think it has to do with multiple providers. It has to do with the ability to cover all the services that are needed.
Okay. All right. Are there any other factors in regard to the transition that people want to highlight here? Joanne.
It may have been just some of the other principles we talked earlier about. I think for transitions to work well, you need to be sure that you have education and both in terms of the options, but also education about the experience that we're having with certain entities to give consumers that choice. So for me, continuity is important, but also is having enough information to make an educated decision.
Okay. Jim, did you want to say anything?
I don't know what we've all talked about, but caregiver continuity is really important.
Carol, to add on to what Joanne said, but is there, right now, the local social service districts do a lot of monitoring in terms of if someone has transitioned, are the services in place, both transitioning in and transitioning out. And I think that taking that layer away erodes a lot of protection and oversight. So is there a way, or will there be a way that the local districts are going to still be involved in monitoring, you know, like if there's a problem with transition and I don't like it, and this person says, but this is what you, whatever, you can always call the local social service district and say something's not right, and they would look into it. So
I think that just raises the question of, how are we going to monitor this?
Exactly.
Kevin, I think you had brought up this point at a prior meeting. Like, once you set this in motion, what's going to be the monitoring mechanism? So that there are going to be problems. I mean, when you're making such a transformation in a very large and complex system, there will be problems. So I think we need to think about what are viable monitoring mechanisms to pick up those problems and try to address them quickly. And those problems can be consumer problems, they can be plan provider problems, they can come from many different sources.
You know,
right.
If you're disenrolling someone, it's the problem making sure everything's in place.
Right, right. So we need to think about that during the transition. Okay. So, yes, Joe.
Yes, NIASA has a sort of managed long-term care committee. We were actually meeting yesterday. We talked about a number of things that need to be in place, we think, before April. One of them is redundant with what we were talking about earlier this morning around fair hearing, but specific to it on a tactical basis, again, to deal with the issues, is we need a timely process, appropriately staffed, in place before this begins to unfold. I think we need to address so we can catch things quickly and resolve them quickly, rather than there's great risk, I think, of the transition overwhelming the resources that are in place right now. I think we also need to deal with some of the financial issues because there are big financial issues in play here. And we didn't do this with the job transition that started. We really need the home attendant programs. There are much larger programs out there that are going to be impacted by this. We need to get it in place, I think, before it all happens.
All right. So let me try to capture where I think we're going from here. We're going to revise the principles based on the feedback you gave us today. Two among you have assignments, Ms. Shaw and Mr. McNally. And you need to get your revisions to us so we can incorporate them in the revised principles. We're going to share those with you, and we're going to try to schedule one more meeting of this group. We're trying for the week of October 17th or October 24th, and Mark's office is trying to do that. And we hope at that meeting to try to get consensus on the recommendations that we will bring to the full MRT. To the extent possible, we'll try to get the principles out to you. So if you have modifications or things you want to bring to our attention, please do so as quickly as possible, and we'll try to react to them.
Can we go for the week of the 17th is the Consumer Direct, the national statewide meeting that week. So if you cannot do that week, would be good.
All right.
Yes. Well,
we're trying.
I have an incredibly talented secretary that's working on trying to coordinate all this stuff. So
okay.
We'll push the options out and do the best we can.
So Carol,
yes, Jim.
So we're going to turn around the recommendations as well as the principles.
Yes. Right.
Yep.
We're going to try to get the principles revised and also put together the recommendations.
Carol, David. I know you're trying to wrap up. I just, if I could go back to the continuity of care conversation. Excuse me. I mean, I'm hoping that this leads to better care, right? Better managed care for those long-term care. So toward that end, I know how important the continuity of care is, but I'm hoping somewhere in that process of continuity is also the consumer's preferences. You know, if perhaps the consumer is somewhere, maybe their needs have changed during that transition period, so they need something different, or maybe perhaps they want something different than what they've had. And I'm hoping somehow in that transition period of continuity care that those, if whatever options are available to them, that they are clearly defined and know that they have them available to them.
Well, I think overall, you know, one of the things we're trying to do here is how to really embed consumer preferences and a consumer voice into the system. And, you know, I think that is a challenge across the board. I know we're tackling it in this quality subcommittee. And right now, the main way that we get the consumer voice is through surveys. I don't know if that's adequate. I mean, it's one of the things we're asking ourselves. So, but that is an important consideration in a long-term care system. So let me just try again to say we're going to try to revise the principles. We're going to put together the recommendations. We're going to incorporate Melanie and David's comments and revisions, and we will try to get those out to you as swiftly as we can. At the same time, we're going to schedule another meeting in mid to late October. My own sort of thinking is that we need another meeting of the quality subcommittee, and we've got to take this and move this ball down the road. So I'm going to schedule another meeting of that subcommittee, which is a very good group, I have to say. I've been very impressed with a lot of the thinking that's gone on in that group. Michael.
Can we make sure that we schedule that subcommittee meeting when, not before, but after the state can share its submission to the feds on the health home quality metrics?
Okay. All right. We'll try to synchronize that. Okay. And then the remaining question is whether or not, and we will also take a look at the recommendations from the group. Doug, Tom, I guess, left Michael and Mary, and see how we pull any of those recommendations in. So the last question is whether or not there's any value in scheduling another meeting of the fair hearing subcommittee, or do we kind of have a sense of the issues and the lay of the land there?
I'd like to disseminate what the minutes were for the people who were there or not on the unfunded committee.
That was, my understanding was it was distributed to them.
But I'd ask them to give us comments.
I'll be happy to do that. We asked for feedback, so.
Okay, I'd like to just get those of you who participated, whether you think there's any value. If not, we don't need to meet just to meet.
Well, it might be helpful to pull the whole group, because there are several folks that are important that aren't here, that were on that call,
mm-hmm.
who might be interested in having input on that question.
Okay. So, Eli, I think, you know, you should be the one to sort of take a look at that. Is there anything else anyone wants to bring up? Yes, Joe.
Sorry to beat a dead horse, but I think we're pretty close to agreement on the central component of the principles. What's not clear, what is clear is it's not our job to figure out what the reimbursement models are, what these new programs are, et cetera. The question is, for people who are trying to propose something, where do they go? I think an action item is to figure out, so where does that conversation go?
If you want to propose a model that you think would improve.
Well, I don't, but I know some others do. So,
the question is, where do you
where do they take it?
Okay, Mark.
I mean, there's a number of different avenues. You can email myself. There's a CML set up for the committee that people should feel comfortable. You know, written material. I'm not going to throw in my boss here, but Jim's always available to meet with people. He was waiting for me to do that, but we're more than willing to take it.
I think it's a really important issue, important enough that if there needs to be a work group on that, to try and put it together. I've been on the stage here for a lot of years of work, and it's a very complex and difficult issue. We don't know if there's an answer there, but certainly, I think we would be willing to work with whatever
providers. So, I mean, let's think about whether we should have a small subgroup be the ones who take a look at whatever proposals there are.
And this is a process. So while the work of the MRT and the MRT subcommittees are moving forward, and their activities may end at a given point, that doesn't mean to say that the work will end, and probably there'll be other mechanisms as well that the state will figure out to go ahead and grab onto that piece, because it would be a shame not to continue the dialogue. Constructively, it's been very, very helpful in shaping what we're doing, so I would think that would be something the state would support.
I mean, as I look at this, I think we want to have the best long-term care system we can have, and build on the assets that we already have in this state. And so if this is going to help us to get there, we should find a way to be able to look at creative proposals. Okay, that being said, I think we will conclude, and we will be in contact. And thanks, everyone, for your participation today.
And you finished 5 minutes
early. Right.
I'm going to try to say.
he had a dinner that I was thinking.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.